Welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show's Tech Tuesday, keeping you on the cutting edge of the tech revolution from WAMU 88.5 FM in Washington.
From WAMU at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Many of us are used to the idea of call centers in India, but what about transcontinental scam artists? As distances break down in the global village, con men on the other side of the world can seem right around the corner. We all know to be at least a little skeptical of a letter from Nigeria promising easy riches, but in an age of internet phones and voice over IP, you should also be thinking twice about a phone call from a local number promising to clear up, say, a jury summons. That local caller could be in Russia. The FBI has made fighting global fraud its third highest priority, just behind terrorism and drugs, and the government has begun to strike back. Last week, they announced their first wave of arrests, netting over 500 people on three continents in a program dubbed Operation Global Con. In this hour, we'll explore the international reach of fraud networks and how police and thieves harness new computer technologies. We'll also hope to identify what you need to know to avoid getting caught up. Joining us in the studio is Brian Krebs, staff writer with WashingtonPost.com. Brian Krebs, welcome.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Alan Pallard, director of research from the SANS Institute. Hi, Alan. How are you?
Hi, Coach. It's great to be back.
We're inviting you to join this conversation on Tech Tuesday scams by calling 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Alan, scam networks have existed for a very long time, yet it seems like law enforcement and computer professionals have been alarmed about recent developments. Have things gotten noticeably worse in recent years?
It looks like the rate of success of these criminals has skyrocketed in the last 2 years. One of the banks is reporting a tripling of successful fraud cases just in the last 12 months. So something's going on around the world that's really making this accelerate.
What is that something, Brian Krebs? Have you been able to find out?
Oh, absolutely. It's profit. It's good old-fashioned greed and money. And it's easier than ever to get through security vulnerabilities or just plain old-fashioned trickery.
And technology is facilitating the speed at which this can be done?
Absolutely. And in a lot of cases, we're starting to see some of the track back on the technology, if you will. I'll give you an example. Everybody's gotten one of these phishing scams, right? They show up as an email. They say there's been some weird activity on your account. We need you to verify your account details or update them. Well, you click on the link, and it takes you to a site that looks like your bank, but it's actually set up by the bad guys to steal your information. The scams we started to see earlier this year, sort of a weird variation on that. Basically, you get you might come home, Kojo, and you get a voicemail or a message on your machine that says, Mr. Nande, this is your bank. We need you to go ahead and give us a call at this 800 number. There's been some weird activity on your account. We need you to verify it. And you know, you call it up and you get this voice prompt. Everybody's used to dealing with voice prompts, right? It asks you to enter your credit card and your number and your social security number and your zip code, and game over.
Good grief. Alan, over 500 arrests in five countries. What type of fraud schemes were uncovered by this Operation Global Con?
This one's looking at people basically stealing money. They scare you or they promise you something. They either promise that you have just come into a $4.5, for example, million-dollar award or inheritance, but you have to send them money for insurance. And later they'll come back to you and say you have to send them more money for other things. So you think you've just gotten rich. They're going to take a little money off the top. And it's that kind of scam over and over again. The FBI and the Federal Trade Commission have done a great job on hitting what we call the low-hanging fruit.
Of course, in order to do this, the FBI had to cooperate with different countries over a period of time. And it would appear that that worked out pretty well from what we can tell, Brian.
Yes, in this case it did. I think Alan hit it on the head that they are doing what they can, and it is important for the law enforcement folks to make examples of the folks that they can round up and bring to justice. But I do think it's true what Alan said, which is that these guys sort of represent the low-hanging fruit. And the interesting thing that we're really seeing more of is the real hardcore bad guys who are orchestrating a great deal of this fraud out there are doing so out in the open. And if you have some investigatory resources, I myself have been able to track down some of these people. And like I said, they're doing it out in the open because they can.
Well, by the way, we'll be joined by a spokesperson for the Fraud Prevention of the Criminal Division of the U.S. Department of Justice to tell us a little more about Operation Global Con in a second. But when you say they're doing it out in the open, I know what that phrase out in the open means, but exactly what are they doing out in the open?
Well, for instance, they might send you an email that asks you to click on a link. And when you click on that link, you go to a website that uses a flaw in your browser to install a virus on your machine silently, a drive-by install. You'll never know it. And this thing just sits there and waits for you to go to a banking site, or it scours the information on your machine, looks for credit card numbers, that kind of thing.
And you can find out who runs that website?
Well, the information has to go somewhere, right? And in this case, you follow the money, right? And you follow it back to servers in Russia and Ukraine or even North Africa. We've seen one group operating out of Russia, like I said, sort of out in the open, because with a little bit of finagling, you can actually get into their database of victims and see the enormous cost that these guys, the toll that they take on the victims, tens of thousands of victims from all around the world. It's staggering.
Doesn't it have to be then that this is being done with, in a way, the tacit authority of the governments of these other countries until such time as they're approached by an agency like the FBI or some other international agency?
I think the numbers are so high, Kojo, that that's why we use the term low-hanging fruit, that even if you find the first 10 of them, you haven't found the next 100 of them, and you haven't even begun to find the hidden ones that aren't so much out in the open. So law enforcement's very good when somebody comes to them and shows them the evidence, and they can go after it. But people all over the world are beginning to see this as a profession rather than as a crime. They're beginning to see stealing money on the internet as a thing you grow up to do. And as Asia comes online, the number of people who see this as a profession is skyrocketing.
So the difference between Willie Sutton, I go to banks because that's where the money is, and the people you're talking about now is a matter of distance, the fact that he had to actually walk into the bank and steal money, and the fact that they are maybe in another country someplace else, the reason why they can see one as a crime and the other as a profession?
It's not clear that Willie Sutton didn't see it as a profession.
As a profession.
Yeah, but I think that you've isolated the difference, and that is that they're invisible in this crime, and so they feel invulnerable.
I'd also like, I'm sorry, Alan,
ahead,
I'd
please.
Like to add something to that.
Sure.
That is, a lot of these scammers, I think they have an attitude, if they're in Russia or they're in the East Asia, like Alan was talking about, they have an attitude about Americans that makes it very easy for them to steal from us.
These deep-pocketed people who can afford to lose some money.
Fat Americans, they've got more money than they know what to do with, besides their credit card companies going to reimburse them, And also, a lot of these scammers reside in countries where there's a great deal of poverty, there's a great deal of corruption, so there's not a whole lot of investment by that country in the internet infrastructure and the things that make global commerce go around, and so there isn't much of an interest by the local authorities in sort of cracking down on this kind of thing.
Brian Krebs is a staff writer with WashingtonPost.com. He joins us in the studio on this Tech Tuesday to discuss cybercrime and cybercrime busting, along with Alan Paller, Director of Research at the SANS Institute. We're inviting your phone calls at 800-433-8850. If you're hearing this stuff and it's freaking you out, well, maybe you need to find out from the experts why it's not freaking them out. Alan Paller, you see this stuff all the time, more and more, every day. How come you're not simply afraid to surf the web anymore?
I'm not afraid to surf the web because of two things. One is the computers that I use are not set up the way Microsoft sold them to me. And two is that I'm just extremely unwilling to believe an offer that's unbelievable. So the one that actually got me in terms of an offer that I thought a lot of people would fall for is one you mentioned in your opening, and I just thought we ought to bring it back up.
Sure.
Because people might miss it. This is one of those voice over IP ones where it looks like it's a local call. Mm-hmm. Voice over IP allows you to have a phone number even if you're in another country that looks like it's a 202 or a 301. And your call comes from the court system in Maryland or in D.C. or in Virginia, and it says you forgot to respond to the summons. Not that you forgot to respond to the jury notification, and because you did, the judge has issued a bench warrant for you. That scares people.
Yep,
would scare me.
Yeah, and that level of fear with a local phone number seems to be pretty effective, and so that's the kind of thing you just have to be. You have to respond to with a, well, maybe you are or maybe you aren't. You ask for their phone number, but you also look up in the phone book the number of the courts, and you call the number of the courts. You say, would people be calling me? And that's a lot of extra work. Mm-hmm. It's more convenient to act to give them all the data that they ask for. And when you've given them all the data,
your Social Security number for sure is one of the things they're
and a credit card to pay the fine.
Correct.
And a bunch of other stuff. Mother's maiden name to make sure you're who you say you are.
And you're saying to yourself, maybe I just didn't notice that I got this jury summons.
It's very easy to get beaten by that one.
800-433-8850 is the number to call if you have concerns about being scammed in a high-tech way. 800-433-8850. Here now is Stephen in Ellicott City, Maryland. Stephen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good evening, or good afternoon, gentlemen. I was just recently a recipient of credit card fraud, and during the conversation with my bank, which was Bank of America, I was told that the vast majority of the cards or numbers that are being stolen today are actually from handheld skimmers in restaurants and other places where you physically give your card to.
And exactly how is that done, Brian? One place I read the same kind of machine in a hotel that is used to change the room key cards is the same kind of machine that you can simply swipe and get somebody's credit card information.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, basically the way you do this is you get a little card reader, and it's a tiny device that fits in the palm of your hand. You can actually buy these off of eBay for a few hundred bucks. And once you run a card through it, it acts just like the machine at the register. It records the information that's encoded on the card. There is no doubt that that this type of fraud goes on. If you just have to look at the Justice Department's own press releases on their cybercrime site to see the people they're busting in the service industry that are doing this kind of thing. But I would caution the caller to not completely buy that explanation, because while it is fairly common, I doubt it accounts for most of the fraud. All of the banks have a vested interest in making sure that people feel comfortable doing things like banking online, because it's extremely cost effective for them. They when they have to pay somebody to service a customer at a teller, person to do this, it costs a whole lot more than to have a website set up that they can help you. So that's my two cents on that.
Stephen, how did you ultimately get it resolved?
Well, the credit card company actually just canceled the card and sent me a new one, and without any question. And I think there was only one or two attempts at the fraudulent activity, and it was a European internet telephone service, I believe an actually valid service. Now, being a computer professional, I'm significantly leery of using my credit card on the internet. However, I do. But I can say that I don't think I've ever been phished. I've never clicked on an email that or went to a website or entered my information anywhere I didn't feel extremely comfortable in doing so. And I have, the top-of-the-line antivirus and firewall, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, it was the most logical scenario is that I actually physically gave my card to someone.
Yep.
But again, I would like to hear, other than websites that fish, another possibility for me to have had my card stolen.
Stephen, thank you for your call. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with phishing, it's P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. It's mining for personal data using fake websites designed to look like well-known websites, essentially. Right, Alan?
Perfect.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Jonathan Rush, who is Special Counsel for Fraud Prevention in the Criminal Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, and later with Audrey Lanford, Co-Director of ScamBusters.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 FM. Coming up later this afternoon at 3 o'clock on The World, some HIV-positive children in Kenya are promoting AIDS awareness and becoming pop celebrities. We hear how music is filling the AIDS education gap for East Africans who can't read. That story, plus today's news from around the globe, coming up on The World at 3 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5 FM. WAMU can help you clear some space by towing away your used car, truck, boat, or RV. When you donate your vehicle to WAMU, you support the news, talk, and music programs that you depend on. Call today to arrange a pickup at 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org for more information. And thank you.
Support for WAMU comes from Chevron, who, along with its partners, are powering a fleet of emission-free fuel cell buses with Chevron hydrogen, because Chevron believes it takes all kinds of energy to get energy.
And from American University's Kogod School of Business, the Kogod Master's Degree in Information Technology Management will help advance your career in IT. Information session on June 7th, registration at kogod.american.edu or 202-885-1913. It's currently 91 degrees in northwest Washington. Our forecast for the afternoon, mostly sunny skies, high temperatures in the lower to mid-90s. And now at 12:23, we return to the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5 FM.
A Tech Tuesday on cybercrime and cybercrime busting with Alan Peller, Director of Research at the Sands Institute, and Brian Krebs, staff writer at WashingtonPost.com. Joining us now by telephone is Jonathan Rush, Special Counsel for Fraud Prevention, Criminal Division, U.S. Department of Justice. Jonathan Rush, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Kojo.
Operation Global Con, 565 arrests in several different countries, yet I get the impression that this may only be the beginning.
I think you're right, Kojo. From our perspective in federal law enforcement here in the United States, and I think from our conversations with our counterparts in a number of foreign countries, this is, in some respects, the tip of the iceberg, although it represents a fairly substantial tip so far as we're concerned.
One of the reasons it represents clearly a substantial tip is not only the amount of people that you were able to nab, but the amount of cooperation you had to get from foreign governments.
Yes, I think that's one of the things that we had hoped to accomplish through GlobalCon. Over the last couple of years, we've been trying increasingly to build out our network of not just contacts, but operational relationships with foreign law enforcement authorities in a number of different countries, particularly where, as a result of sharing information and intelligence with our foreign law enforcement partners, we could identify some of the major trends in terms of large-scale fraud schemes and where those trends seem to be going.
Tell me about the fact that since a lot of these operations come from poor countries, that the countries involved in the first wave of arrests, Spain, the Netherlands, Canada, Costa Rica, those countries are not exactly known as global hotspots of fraud. Why those countries?
Well, this is part of what we learned from our collective discussions among U.S. and foreign law enforcement authorities. What we had seen after late 2004 was a continuing growth in trends where significant fraud schemes that were using mass marketing techniques, combinations of the internet, telemarketing, mass mailings, and so on, were increasingly reaching not just into the United States, but into multiple foreign countries, in effect, to expand their frame of reference, their circle of potential victims, to as wide a scope as possible. And what we had seen in particular was that in places like Spain and the Netherlands, for example, we were seeing significant concentrations of certain kinds of advance fee fraud schemes, identity theft and fraud rings that were especially building up their operations, but targeting the United States, Canada, and other countries. And we found much the same thing to be true in Costa Rica. We were seeing American and Canadian nationals who had gone down to Costa Rica and set up shop there basically to run the same kinds of traditional fraud schemes that even 5-10 years ago would have been most commonly associated with the United States and Canada as a place to find them.
We've talked a little bit about how many of these global fraud networks operate with apparent impunity and maybe even tacit cooperation with authorities in other countries. Any countries you're having difficulty getting cooperation from because they don't feel that their citizens are targets of this kind of fraud?
I think what's actually happened in the last several years, Kojo, is that we have, in building up our partnerships with various countries like Canada, the Netherlands, Spain, and other countries, is that they recognize that even though scam artists may be smart enough, in one sense, not to target nationals of the same countries in which they're doing business, the same country from which they're operating, there is a real problem if they recognize that criminal rings, criminal organizations are behind these types of operations, and to the extent that multiple law enforcement agencies can identify this as a significant trend, where it's not some amateurs who are throwing together a scam just to make some extra money, but are doing this on a professionalized and consistent basis to maximize their revenue flows for the purpose of furthering their criminal operations, the more countries we see who find the value in partnerships like GlobalCon and are willing to work more closely with us.
This question, I guess, is for all of you gentlemen, including you, Alan and Brian. We've seen increasingly sophisticated computer scams, but Operation GlobalCon also targeted what could be termed the classics, the Ponzi schemes, the Nigerian 419 fraud letters. Is technology creating new scams or just making old scams appear and operate in a more sophisticated manner?
We see them being exactly the same scams, just automated, but the automation is accelerating. For example, we used to teach people don't open an attachment until you check with the person who sent the attachment. Now the con software automatically sends a response when you ask, did you really send it? The software that's taken over the person's machine says, oh, yes, I sent it. So the acceleration of technology is being applied here, but the scams are pretty much the same scams.
Brian?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the technology that it takes to run a scam and be very successful at it is widely available, and it's not hard to master. I've seen this in my own reporting with 15-year-olds who can take control of a couple of machines, send out a few million emails, and within the span of 48 hours, they control tens of thousands of computers. It's pretty ridiculous.
But Jonathan, a lot of times we think that this is simply some individual teenager sitting alone in an apartment in another country. But after listening to Alan and Brian, I also get the impression that these are traditional criminal networks that have merely moved their operations into the high-tech environment, and that one of the reasons that authorities in those countries need to check on them is that they are generally involved in a variety of criminal enterprises.
I think that's a fair statement, Kojo. What we saw, for example, in one of our GlobalCon cases that involved excellent cooperation with Dutch law enforcement authorities is that some of the fraud rings that were based in Amsterdam are, you might say, full-service businesses in crime. They not only run the traditional 419 schemes, they're running phishing operations. They run other types of things basically to maximize the flow of valuable personal data, credit card accounts, bank accounts, and so on, to make their operation as lucrative as possible, leveraging technology wherever possible to maximize their ability to get that information in as quickly as they can.
Jonathan Rush, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Coach.
Jonathan Rush is Special Counsel for Fraud Prevention, Criminal Division, U.S. Department of Justice. If you have called us, stay on the line. We will get to your telephone call. I just wanted to talk to a few of our guests whose time is limited first. Joining us now by telephone is Audrey Lanford, co-director of scambusters.org. Audrey, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Coach.
Audrey, you've been doing Scambusters for over 10 years. In that time, what kind of changes have you observed in the way these things operate?
We've seen a lot of, number one, an enormous increase in the amount of scam activity, of course. We've also seen them become much more sophisticated. But that doesn't mean that you don't still have exactly the same things going on that we saw 11 years ago.
So you've got that and then some.
Exactly right.
Allow me to go to Brian in Bethesda, Maryland. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My mother-in-law she's 70, and she's not really up to date on some of these new problems. She told me she gave her Social Security number to a marketer on the telephone the other day. Now, I think I would know what to do if a credit card number was stolen, but what should we do to protect her identity if she really did give her Social Security number to a scammer?
Audrey?
Well, that is much tougher. I mean, you're exactly right. Giving a credit card number, all you have to do is cancel the credit card, let the credit card company know, and then monitor your credit. With a Social Security number, you certainly need to do those. You need to alert the credit agencies and so on. But you definitely need to be monitoring her credit very carefully because, you know, the impact of that can happen for many years in the future. So that is definitely a very dangerous thing.
Audrey, do you also, this is Alan, do you also recommend that they put a freeze on their credit reports if that's happened or in the 20 states where that's legal? Is that something you recommend?
It is something that we recommend, but we want to make sure people realize that that is not necessarily going to solve the problem. It can help, but most of the time that's voluntary. So people can still open up new accounts, bank accounts, credit cards, et cetera. So there's definitely an advantage to doing it, but people shouldn't get a sense of false security that they've done that. Do you agree with that?
Sure.
Brian, thank you very much for your call.
I'm sorry, could you explain what you meant by putting a freeze on your credit reports?
Sure. You can call and then put into writing with the three major credit bureaus a freeze. And what that will do is it will alert the authorities that there might be a problem and that you can that they should ask for additional information and notify you if there is a problem. It's not a law that they have to, and that's where the problem comes in. But very often they will, so you will at least have more of a chance of seeing what's going on. It also makes it much more difficult if you really do want to open up a new account. There are additional procedures that have to happen.
Brian Krebs?
Yeah, Audrey, I just wanted to ask you if you thought there was any difference or benefit between these putting a freeze on your credit report and signing up for one of these 1099 a month services with the credit bureaus or the banks to have them monitor your credit. I mean, is there any difference, really?
Well, actually, personally, we recommend using the services that monitor your credit as opposed to the freezes, unless you know that there's, you know, been identity theft. And the reason for that is they're expensive. A lot of people have a problem with the fact, and rightly so, that, you know, that they are that expensive and that they should be free because, and there are a whole variety of reasons for that that I won't go into. But the bottom line is that they're not free, so your choice really is it worthwhile or isn't it for you? And you will, when you monitor your credit, you will know whenever anybody does an inquiry, opens an account, et cetera. And for us, that's really valuable. I mean, personally, we do that, and we recommend it to our subscribers.
Brian, thank you very much for your call. You too can call us, 800-433-8850. Audrey Lanford is co-director of scambusters.org. That's a nonprofit newsletter that addresses the issues of cybercrime and the like. We're also talking with Alan Peller, director of research with the Sands Institute, and Brian Krebs, staff writer with WashingtonPost.com. Audrey, you talk about the importance of being open about being scammed, that just keeping it to yourself can be counterproductive. Why?
Well, there are a couple of things. One of the things that we've found over the years is that people get very embarrassed that they've been scammed. And so, number one, they don't report it. And number two, they don't let anybody know. They don't do anything to really protect themselves. And so when we get scammed, we're very, very public about it because we figure that people will feel like they're less stupid when, you know, somebody who's been doing this for over 11 years occasionally will get scammed as well.
Yep. Have you been scammed?
We've been scammed a number of times over the years. Sure. I think we are pretty good at this.
Well, you did say one and two, one of them is reporting and the other is making sure it doesn't happen again. Brian Krebs, I know you've criticized the view held by some in government that the key is simply reporting. Why is that not enough?
Well, reporting, just because you have the information doesn't mean you have the power to do much with that information. The banks themselves are very, very at least in the United States, the financial institutions have a great deal of information about fraud. They know exactly how much fraud is going on, but they're not required to report this information publicly. They're not required to share it, although I think they do share it with the law enforcement folks. But just having the information doesn't necessarily mean you have the power to do anything about it. Ellen, I don't know if you have anything to...
Well, I think the reason it doesn't, that's not a good policy is that people won't report.
Right.
That they feel the price of reporting is higher than the benefit they'll get from reporting, and they just don't report. And that's at least a 10-to-1 ratio.
Audrey, your thoughts?
I completely agree.
Okay, then on to Ben in Ohio. Ben, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I wanted to contribute to the program, and thank you for taking my call. One of my friends recently was scammed for about $7,000 for winning a lottery. And personally, I surf the net a lot, and I receive a lot of those emails. Some of them will be like a business, and they want a business partner. Some of them, they will say you've won a lottery, and you have to pay this amount. I don't follow all those things because I know better. But my problem is, how about this computer softwares? I know about iSpy now. There's a software that can actually send an email to somebody else's computer and take total control of it. And it's a legitimate software that they sell. What's the government doing about that? Because I know if somebody is able to do that, send information to your computer and control your computer, there's a possibility that the person will have access to all those information. And talking about the credit monitoring companies, I use one of the credit monitoring companies. I'm not going to mention their name on air. I recently had a problem with them because they gave my credit card information to another company for them to deduct money off my credit card, just simply because there was a link on the credit monitoring company website that I clicked on it, and they said the moment you clicked on it, you agree to their terms and conditions, and they start charging you. So to me, it's harder to prevent all those issues. But when that incident happened, I canceled my subscription with the credit monitoring company, and then find out that I don't have any other choice but to re-sign up with a different company. So talking about those things, I think the best way, the best place to start with would be those people too, like the companies that share people's information without their consent with other businesses.
Well, you've raised several issues. Allow me to have anybody who feels like responding to any of them start by doing so. I know the first issue you raised is about people who have software programs that are able to take advantage of other computers. And I know you have been writing recently, Brian Krebs, about ransomware, and it seems that there's a relationship there. So you might want to talk about that briefly.
Ransomware. Yeah, that's a scary concept. Essentially, it's basically a virus that gets on your machine, either because you open it, an attachment, an email, or it takes advantage of a vulnerability in software that you're using that faces the internet. And it gets on your machine, and it's designed to pretty much scramble your personal files, your documents, whatnot, with encryption that's very, very difficult to crack unless you have a password. But you can't get that password unless you agree to pay the ransom, which usually means wiring some money over some electronic service to the scammers. And we're seeing more of this, and it is getting more sophisticated, using higher levels of encryption that are harder to crack.
Any responses, Alan, to what our caller Ben has been talking about?
Yeah, there's an underlying wave that he mentioned, spyware, software that gets on your machine and does something. Ransomware is an example of that. That's the underlying wave that's helping to enable a lot of this, a lot of the theft. To me, the worst crime is not your credit card being lost because you tend to be covered, but your bank account being emptied. And if you're an individual, the banks have traditionally covered you, but they don't have to, and it's getting so big that they're going to stop pretty soon. And if you're a small business running your business out of your home, they don't cover you at all. So you lose your entire – if you're running a small business, Kojo Inc., in the same place you're running your personal account, they cannot cover that loss. So you want to stop that software from getting on your machine because that's the same software that sends out the spam. It's the same software that sends out the phishing notes. You want to keep it off your machines. And the way you do that is by being a whole lot more defensive in your use of the internet than we're used to being.
Audrey?
Well, I would just like to respond to the I think those are excellent points. I'd just like to respond also to the concept of the idea of being charged for these additional things by clicking on something that you weren't really paying attention to. And the caller is absolutely right. I mean, one of the biggest complaints about the credit monitoring companies is that these kinds of things, unfortunately, often do happen. And so you have to be incredibly careful if you do sign up for credit monitoring that you really pay attention to what you're doing, because otherwise you'll wind up with a problem exactly like the caller just described.
Audrey Lanford, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Audrey Lanford is co-director of scambusters.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about cyber crime busting with Brian Krebs and Alan Peller. And you can call us 800-433-8850. If the lines are busy, send us an email to kojo@wamu.org with your question or comment. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, it's been called a 45-carat magnet of misfortune. Hear the stories behind the Hope Diamond, arguably the world's most famous blue gem, today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5 FM.
And then at 2 o'clock on Talk of the Nation, 25 years ago, the first cases of AIDS devastated those affected. A look at AIDS 25 years later, that's Talk of the Nation at 2 o'clock here on WAMU. And then at 3 on The World, some HIV-positive children in Kenya are promoting AIDS awareness and becoming pop celebrities. We hear how music is filling the AIDS education gap for East Africans who can't read. That story and the day's news from around the globe coming up on The World at 3 o'clock. Here on WAMU 88.5 FM.
Support for WAMU comes from the German Embassy and the German School of Washington, now offering registration for German language classes. More information on Germany and German language classes at germany.info.
And from American University's Kogod School of Business, the Kogod Master's Degree in Information Technology Management will help advance your career in IT. Information session on June 7th, registration at kogod.american.edu or 202-885-1913. Our forecast this afternoon, mostly sunny skies, hot with highs in the lower to mid-90s. It's already 91 degrees in northwest Washington at 1244. As we return now to the Kojo Nandi Show here on WAMU 88.5 FM.
It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about cybercrime and cybercrime busting. Victims of internet fraud schemes should file complaints online with the Internet Crime Complaint Center. That's a joint project of the FBI and the National White Collar Crime Center at www.ic3.gov, and you can find a link to that website if you go to kojoshow.org. Victims of telemarketing fraud should contact the Federal Trade Commission's Consumer Sentinel, either by calling the FTC's toll-free number 1-877-987-3728 or by filing an online form available through its website, www.ftc.gov. Again, you will find links to all of that at our website, kojoshow.org. We're talking with Brian Krebs, staff writer with WashingtonPost.com, and Alan Peller, director of research with the Sands Institute. Brian, we're telling people about all the things that can happen. What we have not yet told them about is how they can have a fairly good measure of online security when they go online, so they're not sweating and nervous all the time.
Right. Right. Well, one of the key things is obviously to stay up to date on security updates. Obviously, Microsoft ships updates to its system that are very important to apply as soon as possible. But the bad guys also are going after the applications that run atop the operating system. And the Sands Institute has talked a lot about this. But essentially, you know, the media players, the video players, the music players, there are flaws in these applications, and they need to be updated as well with security fixes, because the bad guys are exploiting flaws in those as well. And that's part of the reason we created the Security Fix blog at WashingtonPost.com, is to help people stay up to date with that. But there's also another aspect here, which is not running, as Alan said, not running the PC as Microsoft ships it, which is to say, if you're running it in the default configuration, if you're running a Windows machine, chances are you're running it as the all-powerful God administrator account, which means you can do whatever you want on the machine. You can install, delete, move files, whatever. The problem with that is when you run across a website that takes advantage, you're cruising the web, right, and you take advantage, you visit a site that may be hacked or maybe it's malicious and it takes advantage of a flaw you don't know about, and all of a sudden you get a drive-by install and you don't even know it. And the reason that happens is because you're running the browser under the administrator rights, which means it's allowed to install software. And there are ways, and I guess I'll let Alan talk about this a little bit.
Yes, how do we lower the rights of our browsers?
It's actually a tiny bit complicated, and Brian has a wonderful blog on it. You should have kept the mic, Brian. But it's on your website, Coach. There's a pointer to WashingtonPost.com, and there's a blog on exactly how to lower your rights. It's worth it because you can't be perfect in keeping all of your patches up to date. Some of these things happen a little too fast. So this is the second line of defense. But I want to sort of trebly reinforce Brian's statement about turning on automatic patching, not only for your operating system, but for any applications that offer it.
Really, I just wanted to add one thing, if
sure.
I could. The lowering your rights is so important because the way Microsoft has set up its operating system is that it's pretty easy for people who don't know what they're doing, who aren't experienced with using the computers and keeping up to date, to mess up their computer. And by lowering your rights, the Apple operating system does this very well. It makes it a lot harder for people to install programs accidentally or to make system changes that can really cause a lot of headaches. So that's what's so important about lowering your rights is even, you know, if you didn't inadvertently make a change that you didn't want to make or you clicked on something you shouldn't have, it'll save you from yourself, essentially.
Aha, saving us from ourselves. Always a good idea. Here's Charlotte in Washington. Charlotte, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hello. Just before your break, I heard a very scary comment from one of your guests about having your bank account cleaned out. And I was wondering if there was any connection between that and online banking. My bank is constantly pressuring my husband and I to bank online, saying it would be so much more convenient. And I think we're sort of pretty much Luddites, and we've resisted that. And I'm just wondering, if you bank online, does it make it more likely that someone could clean out your bank account?
Alan.
I'll just start with online banking is wonderfully convenient. It's going to grow explosively. And with that all said, absolutely, if you do online banking, you put yourself much, much more at risk for having your bank account cleaned out. The banks have traditionally covered your individual accounts. So you don't really, it's like credit card fraud. In general, you don't worry about credit card fraud because they say the credit card companies cover it, but CBS News did a wonderful story. It isn't the credit card companies that are covering you at all. It's the
merchants.
Poor merchants who get ripped off.
Exactly.
But by the credit card companies and the thieves. But in banking, the banks will cover you. So my sense is if the convenience is strong, I'd go ahead and do it because the convenience is wonderful as long as you do the other things to not visit the websites that and not click on the URLs that are going to steal your data.
I know that one of you also said that they might stop covering individual accounts if the problem becomes too big. So it sounds like that's not guaranteed.
There's no guarantee because they can claim you really did steal it. You see the scam that they could claim? They could say, well, you're stealing the money from yourself because the only thing that happened was your username and your password took money out of that account.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's the only fact they have. And you're claiming you didn't do it. But at some point, they can say, well, how do we know you didn't do it and push back on the safety net?
Exactly. And it becomes orders of magnitude harder to claim that you didn't when somebody's got a remote access Trojan on your machine and they're logging in from your machine. At the bank says, well, you know, it's obviously your computer. We know you're at this website address, this internet address. So what gives? And what are you going to say then?
I think I'll keep my faith in the U.S. mail.
Charlotte, thank you very much
for
your call. We got an email from Angeline, who said, I was also just a victim of credit card fraud with the homegrown variety. Luckily, I was checking my card statement and found 3 charges made on my card in the Bronx at a gas station. Each was for $100. The criminals are more than likely U.S. citizens. I don't know why she comes to that conclusion, but she says, my 2 recommendations are for cardholders to check their accounts regularly and for the merchants to require a PIN number at every transaction. How hard could this be, Brian?
Well, I mean, any time you require a more authentication, you basically make it less easy for the user, and a lot of businesses aren't interested in making it harder for the customers.
Here is Roberto in Beltsville, Maryland. Roberto, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
My question is on the Social Security numbers, and why do organizations like the government, credit card stores, still rely so much on Social Security numbers? Think of it as a password. If you think of it as a password, I'm being forced, in a sense, to use a password that was given to me 27 years ago, that I was never able to change. Only contains numbers. I will never be able to change it again. And the first three numbers are really not all that secret in the sense, for example, people from Maryland have social security numbers that can start from 213, 214, this type of numbers. This would be a very, very weak password. So why do we have to be, in a sense, are forced to use this weak password? Thanks.
I don't know if Alan O'Brien can answer that for you. Alan?
The answer to that turns out to be what's called the Mary Brown problem. That hospitals have this. If Mary Brown arrives at the emergency room and you want to make sure you've got her medical records and she's not very communicative, you need to make sure it's the right Mary Brown. And to make sure it's the right Mary Brown, you need some unique identifier of her or you're going to give her the wrong medicine. So these are competing goods going on in the world between keeping your Social Security number out of the hands of the merchants or the hospitals or the banks and giving it to them.
In that situation, Mary Brown probably won't be able to give you her mother's maiden name, depending on how serious a condition she is in. Here is John in Washington. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Hi, John. Are you there? John, I can't hear you, so I'm going to put you on hold. And we had a call from Brian in D.C. who couldn't stay on the line, who says, I have online banking, and the extra pages that the bank puts in place to avoid phishing make it almost too difficult to get to my details. Any comment on that?
I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about.
Me either.
The banks need to do one thing. The banks in Hong Kong have done it. The banks in Singapore have done it. The banks in the Netherlands have done it. And that is they need to give us each a token so that we're not using passwords. It's this business of typing passwords in is putting us all at risk. American banks are just way behind the times.
Alan's talking about a one-time token. That's something that you use once, and it's only good for one session.
Ah, so every time you do your banking, you use a different token.
Yeah, you can get a little pad of them in the mail. You can get a little electronic one. You can use your cell phone. In Hong Kong, everybody's using their cell phone to generate the new tokens. It's very inexpensive, and our banks are just way behind the times.
And it sounds like it makes so much sense. Here's an email we got from Fred, who writes, I'm writing from Silver Spring. I'm retired military, and I'm concerned about the recent loss of personal data from the VA. I want to be able to freeze my credit data at the three credit reporting agencies, but Maryland is not one of the states that provides for that. What rational argument, besides the desire to make unfettered profit, are these companies making that has prevented this type of legislation in the other 38 states? Any idea, Brian?
Well, sure. I mean, the credit industry is an industry unto itself. It is very wealthy. It's very powerful. It has friends in Congress. The fact is that information about consumers is extremely valuable, and not just to the bad guys, to the companies out there that trade in this information, that bank in this information. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Alan, but I know that there are efforts afoot in Congress to make this to change the laws so that sort of they're rationalized nationally as the same. But those efforts also would take away some of the rights that some consumers have in addition to granting new ones.
Okay, here is Judy in Lovettsville, Virginia. Judy, your turn.
Yes. Recently I received a letter on letterhead from the University of Ohio in Athens, which was addressed to alumna and friends, saying that their computer records, 217,000 of them, had been breached and that mine was among them. I think I made a mistake in calling the 800 number. I'd like to know if I made a mistake because, of course, I never have anything to do with this university. And it seemed very odd to me that since I give to specific stations, not to PBS in general, They said that they managed a PBS station. Have I been duped? And if so, what do I need to do about it?
Judy, here's Brian.
Judy, you said you've never attended any classes at the school. You've never given them your information before?
Never.
And how did you receive this notification?
In the U.S. mail.
Uh-huh. Well, I would like to follow up with you on that, because it wouldn't be the first time we've seen people trying to scam folks. What exactly happened when you called the number?
Well, I said that doesn't sound very plausible to me, and they said, well, I'm just a student. I'll go ask my supervisor, which I don't believe for 30 seconds.
did they ask you for any information, though?
No, they didn't.
Well, Judy, I'm going to put you on hold, and we're going to take your information, and after the broadcast, Brian will be able to get in touch with you.
Yeah, and I can send him a copy of this letter.
Great.
Okay, thank you, and we'll put you on hold. Don't go away so that we can get your information, Alan.
I just wanted to add one more thing, that something we've all been waiting for a while. The FBI, which, by the way, has done, of all the government agencies, they're far better than any others at doing something about cybercrime, but they've come out with a new website called LooksTooGoodToBeTrue.gov. So it's the whole spelling spelled out, LooksTooGoodToBeTrue.gov. And that's a place where you can find out if these things that people are promising you are probably scams. And we've needed a government one, so we had a regular central repository of those.
And please remember, you can go to KojoShow.org to find out what victims of internet fraud schemes can do, but where they can file complaints. Also through KojoShow.org, and you'll find links to where victims of telemarketing fraud should contact. Brian Krebs, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
Brian Krebs is a staff writer with WashingtonPost.com. Alan Paller, good to see you again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Alan is director of research at the Sands Institute. I'm Kojo Namdi.